We're going to continue now with this installment of Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. And again, central to the entire hypothesis that I'm developing is the concept of the tank versus the bulldozer. Not only do tanks add to the public debt they're paid for, and all the parts, the spare, the fuel, etc., paid for by the taxpayer, but beyond that, it should be noted that over the period of the Cold War, an increasing percentage or an increasing amount of America's R&D brains have been devoted to defense spending rather than to updating and upgrading our commercial economies. That also exerted a tremendously destructive effect on the United States. And at some point, I suspect that the destructive effect of the arms race on both the U.S. and the USSR became a major strategic consideration for the Third Reich elements, which, as we have seen in Radio Free America number 2 and in a miscellaneous archive show called the New Germany and the Old Nazis, those elements remained in place in Germany. Many of them are in dominant positions today. What we're going to look at now, and again, we've been taking a look at the way in which the Galen Organization was able to provide grossly exaggerated analyses of how of what the Soviet Union was capable of militarily and what it intended to do, and how those analyses fitted into the agendas of very powerful domestic political forces, both American reactionaries, the so-called military-industrial complex, and how the interaction between this Galen disinformation and the needs and desires of these powerful domestic political forces gave impetus to the Cold War. I'll also recall that the Galen Organization itself served to aggravate the Soviets' attitude as well. They were aware of the Galen Organization and its incorporation into the United States as early as the Potsdam Conference in 1945. What we're going to look at now is the evolution of a Third Reich political warfare and covert action technique, namely the, quote, liberation, unquote, doctrine. And we're going to look at how this Third Reich political warfare technique and doctrine evolved into a major American political force, as well as an American political warfare and covert action doctrine. This as the result of the injection by CIA domestic organizations of many of these same Galen and Galen-related Third Reich alumni into American political life. And the formation of this liberation or rollback milieu is ultimately what we're going to look at here is the creation of the milieu that we looked at in the first two installments of Radio Free America number 37, this intersection of the American radical right, the national security establishment, and many of the Galen and ABN related elements that we took a look at in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy, which among other things represented the triumph, the formal triumph of rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War, and that triumph saw its culmination in the Reagan and Bush years. In a very important chapter in Christopher Simpson's blowback entitled The Politics of Liberation, we find the Central Intelligence Agency did not sever its ties with the extremist exile organizations once they arrived in this country. Instead, it continued to use them in clandestine operations both abroad and in the United States itself. Before the middle of the 1950s, the agency found itself entangled with dozens, and probably hundreds, of former Nazis and SS men who had fought their way into the leadership of a variety of Eastern European emigre political associations inside this country. Instead of withdrawing its support for the extremist groups and for the men and women who led them, the CIA went to considerable lengths to portray these leaders as legitimate representatives of the countries they had fled. At about the same time that the agency initiated the immigration programs discussed in the last chapter, it dramatically expanded its publicity and propaganda efforts inside the United States itself. A major theme of this effort was to establish the credibility and legitimacy of exiled Eastern European politicians, former Nazi collaborators and non-collaborators alike, in the eyes of the American public. Through the National Committee for a Free Europe, or NCFE, and a new CIA-financed group, the Crusade for Freedom, or CFF, The Covert Operations Division of the agency became instrumental in introducing into the American political mainstream many of the right-wing extremist emigre politicians' plans to, quote, liberate, unquote, Eastern Europe and to, quote, roll back communism, unquote. Last sentence again, because it's in many ways the key to this chapter. Through the National Committee for a Free Europe, or NCFE, and a new CIA-financed group, the Crusade for Freedom, or CFF, the Covert Operations Division of the agency became instrumental in introducing into the American political mainstream many of the right-wing extremist emigre politicians' plans to, quote, liberate, unquote, Eastern Europe, and to, quote, roll back communism, unquote. And now here again, we're going to take a look at how the CFF, the Crusade for Freedom, a CIA domestic organization, which was the vehicle to a large extent for interjecting many of these same Third Reich alumni and these same Galen-related elements into American political life and for propagating their views into a mainstream American political force, one of the major motivations for doing this, again, was to generate popular American support for an arms buildup, which was perceived as needed to counteract the Soviet threat, which we have seen was already greatly exaggerated in the minds of American strategic and political thinkers by the Galen disinformation that we looked at in our last segment. And again, many of these same Galen-related elements will now take a major role, or will play a major role, in the formation of American political theory. Simpson writes, at the time, however, it seemed to many that the only possible response to the crisis precipitated by Korea and the Soviet atomic tests was a major escalation of U.S. weapons programs coupled with intensified clandestine campaigns to undermine Soviet rule everywhere it had been established. The price tag for the U.S. arms buildup, according to Paul Nitze, N-I-T-Z-E, who drafted most of the main policy statements on the issue, was some $50 billion, almost three times the then existing U.S. military budget. The real question for U.S. policymakers of the day, write Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas in their study of American policy formulation, The Wise Men, quote, was whether Congress and the administration would pay for it. The public had to be persuaded. The way to do that, Nietzsche knew from experience, was to scare them. To tell them that the Soviets were intent on world domination, that they were poised to attack, and that the U.S. had to meet them everywhere, unquote. It was in this context that the CIA launched a major propaganda effort in the United States. Despite a legal prohibition against domestic activities by the agency, it initiated a multi-million dollar publicity project in this country called the Crusade for Freedom. And skipping down, in reality, one of the most important reasons for the CFF was to bring to America the analysis of foreign affairs that had been developed by the National Committee for a Free Europe and by the CIA. The CFF became a gigantic nationwide drive, unquote, as our Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty director Sig Mikkelsen has put it, quote, to obtain support for the activities of the Free Europe Committee, unquote. The basic message of that analysis was a more aggressive, hard-hitting version of the containment doctrine that would soon come to be known as, quote, liberation, unquote. So stopping to look at what we've seen so far in the analysis of the formation of the liberation milieu, which ultimately was central to the dispatching of President Kennedy and which came to its fruition, its ultimate culmination in the Reagan-Bush years, many of these Galen Third Reich Eastern European emigres, Galen-related Third Reich Eastern European emigres and fascist collaborators are projected into American political life as a result of domestic CIA operations, the chief one among them the Crusade for Freedom. One of the main reasons for doing this was to generate public support for the arms buildup that many American political and military leaders felt was necessary to counter the Soviet threat, which, as we've seen, was already being greatly exaggerated by the Galen disinformation that was presented to the United States. And in turn, the goal of the CFF was to bring the analysis of foreign affairs that was developed by the National Committee for a Free Europe, a CIA front, and by the CIA itself, and by extension also the Galen Organization, to bring to the American public an awareness, the same awareness of the analysis that was dominant within the U.S. national security structure. Skipping down, what we're going to look at now is the evolution of the liberation or rollback philosophy of fighting the Cold War from a Third Reich political warfare technique, because it was begun during the Third Reich, or actually during the Third Reich before World War II, and we're going to look at its evolution into a mainstream American political force. Simpson writes, "Although it was little known in the United States at the time, the genesis of the liberation philosophy can be clearly traced to émigré propagandists who had worked for the Nazis on the Eastern Front during World War II. After the war, the various conservative and liberal anti-communist organizations in the United States that adopted liberation as a rallying cry added new and specifically American elements to the program that altered the earlier German strategy in basic ways. Liberation, in its American version, included an insistence that the anti-communist revolution be democratic rather than fascist in character, and it abandoned the racial theories and anti-Semitism of the earlier Nazi propaganda. Liberation, in the United States' hands, was billed as the fulfillment of America's own revolutionary heritage of resistance to tyranny." I would interject at this point, from the vantage point of 1992, we can look back and see that, in fact, in at least some of the, quote, liberated, unquote, areas, many of these same fascist philosophies are very much alive today, newly independent Croatia being but one example. Continuing. "It is useful to look at the gradual evolution of how these changes took place. The political rhetoric of the extremist exile groups that had once worked for the Nazis also evolved in a complex interaction with the gradual introduction of liberationist thinking into America. By the late 1940s, exiled extremist leaders had learned the rhetoric of this new, more, quote, American, unquote, form of liberation. Their adoption of lip service to democracy began to provide former fascists with a platform to promote their agenda to millions of Americans, and it created a shelter, in effect, that protected them from the exposure of their Nazi pasts." That last sentence again. "Their adoption of lip service to democracy began to provide former fascists with a platform to promote their agenda to millions of Americans, and it created a shelter, in effect, that protected them from the exposure of their Nazi pasts. They were no longer seen as the trigger men of Nazi genocide in the public mind, but rather as fervent anti-communist patriots. The government's intelligence agencies played a substantial role in this shift. The changes in the rhetoric of the extreme Russian nationalist organization Nationalno Trudzvoy Soyuz, or NTS, which is still active in today's Russian emigration, are a case in point." By the way, interjecting, we took a look at the NTS and the participation of NTS elements such as Igor Voshinin in the assassination of John Kennedy in our first two segments. Continuing. "This once openly fascist group was founded in the early 1930s by a congress of younger Russian exiles who had fled their homeland in the wake of the 1917 revolution. During the first decade of its existence, the NTS proclaimed the Nazis as models. NTS members were contemptuous of any sort of democratic norms and of the United States, which they viewed as degenerate. Their party program called for an anti-communist revolution in the USSR, assassination of Soviet leaders, disenfranchisement of Jews, and confiscation of Jewish property. When war broke out, the NTS unhesitatingly rallied to the cause of Nazi Germany. NTS strategy during the conflict, that's World War II, centered on an attempt to convince the Germans to sponsor its members as the new rulers of a puppet state inside the Nazi-occupied zone of the USSR. They gradually became a central part of the Germans' Vlasov Army political warfare project, serving as political officers and informers among the Eastern European troops who had defected to the Nazis." Recall, the Vlasov Liberation Army was a group of Soviet turncoats who fought on behalf of the Third Reich during World War II. They also became a key component of the Galen organization both during and after World War II, when it worked for first the Third Reich and then for the CIA and ultimately West Germany and NATO. Continuing. "As a declassified U.S. State Department study on the group puts it, the NTS, quote, served in the good graces of the Germans and it placed its men under the Kriegsfangen Commissionen, part of the Nazi prisoner of war camp administration, frequently used for interrogation and recruitment of defectors, into the special training camps for politically reliable prisoners, and above all, into the propagandists' schools at Wüstgrau and Dabendorf, as well as into Goebbels' anti-Comintern, a Nazi-sponsored alliance of fascist parties from around the world. Graduates of the NTS training program, the study continues, quote, were assigned to positions in German-occupied Russia, such as chiefs of police, deputy mayors, and propagandists with army units, unquote. Many of the NTS leaders of the 1950s, particularly those who served as police and city administrators in the Nazi occupation zone, are major war criminals who personally helped organize the identification, roundup, and execution of millions of Jewish and Slavic citizens. Insofar as NTS men won control of local administrations in the Nazi-occupied regions of the USSR, the organization became an integral part of the Nazis' propaganda, espionage, and extermination apparatus in the East. The main theme of NTS propaganda throughout the conflict was a campaign to, quote, liberate, unquote, the USSR from Stalin, communism, and the Jews through a mutiny by the Red Army. Recall that we looked at this passage in an earlier installment of RFA 37. Ultimately, that mutiny by the Red Army, the basic tactic espoused by the NTS, was realized with the August coup of 1991 and the resultant mutiny by the Army, which was to result in the outlawing of the Soviet Communist Party and the very dissolution of the Soviet Union itself, a goal long sought by the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, as we looked at earlier in this series. By the way, it's worth noting, too, that the extreme Russian nationalist organization, we'll touch on this later, the extreme Russian nationalist organization Pamyat, P-A-M-Y-A-T, is extremely anti-Semitic, and to a certain extent at least, Pamyat could be seen as the ultimate successor to the NTS, and at least to a certain extent as the realization of some of the political goals that the NTS sought. Continuing with this particular passage from Simpson's Blowback, of the proposed mutiny by the Red Army to, quote, liberate, unquote, the USSR from Stalin, Simpson says, this became the centerpiece of Vlasov Army recruiting efforts at least as early as 1942 and was elaborated in considerable detail with tactics for counterinsurgency operations in the Nazi occupation zone, behind-the-lines infiltration of NTS agents on espionage and sabotage missions, propaganda themes tailored to appeal to Russian sensibilities, and similar specifics. When the Germans were finally driven out of Russia, selected NTS agents were left on, quote, stay-behind, unquote, missions in an attempt to organize subversion in Soviet rear areas once the Red Army front had passed. The NTS also served as the dominant force after the Nazis themselves and the Ruskaya Osvoboditel and Osvoboditelnaya Armia, the Russian Army of Liberation, or Vlasov Army, and the Komitet Osvobozhdenaya Narodov Rossi, German-sponsored Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia, the Nazis' primary front group for Eastern Front political warfare operations in the desperate closing months of the war. By the way, some spellings of the foreign names. Kriegsgefangen Commissionen is K-R-I-E-G-S-G-E-F-A-N-G-E-N-K-O-M-M-I-S-S-I-O-N-E-N. And the Russian names, Ruskaya Osvoboditel Naya Armia, R-U-S-S-K-A-J-A, O-S-V-O-B-O-D-I-T-E-L, N-A-I-A, capital A-R-M-I-I-A, and the Komitet Osvoboditelnaya is O-Z-V-O-B-O-Z-H-D-E-N-I-I-A, and Narodov, N-A-R-O-D-O-V, Rossi, R-O-S-S-I-I. Continuing with Simpson's text, it was through the NTS and through the rival national liberation program sponsored among Soviet minority groups by the Nazis' Rosenberg Ministry, that the strategy and tactics of the liberation of the USSR were first hammered out. These were the laboratory, so to speak, used by Hans Heinrich Herwarth, Gustav Hilger, and the other German political warfare officers discussed earlier to develop the propaganda themes and behind-the-line subversion tactics believed most suitable for reaching people inside the USSR. We're now going to take a look at the evolution of this Nazi political war, Third Reich political warfare and covert action strategy, and see how it evolves into a mainstream, ultimately a dominant American political force. We're going to look at an NTS member here who ultimately was projected into the United States as a, quote, Soviet expert. This guy, by the way, had worked in directing slave labor gangs for the SS. His name is Konstantin Boldyreff, B-O-L-D-Y-R-E-F-F. Simpson writes of him, Konstantin Boldyreff was a founder of NTS and a senior leader of the group throughout the war. His wartime career is shrouded in secrecy today, but it is clear that the Counterintelligence Corps believed that in late 1944 he helped administer gangs of Russian laborers for the SS. He is a case in point of the manner in which the intervention of U.S. intelligence agencies shepherded the migration of liberation propaganda out of the fallen wartime ministries of Berlin and into the living rooms of America. The last sentence again. He is a case in point of the manner in which the intervention of U.S. intelligence agencies shepherded the migration of liberation propaganda out of the fallen wartime ministries of Berlin and into the living rooms of America. According to U.S. Army intelligence records obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, the mainstream U.S. anti-communist organization Common Cause, no relation to the present-day liberal organization of the same name, sponsored the NTS spokesman's travels to the United States in 1948, then gave him a media campaign that enabled him to reach into millions of American homes during the late 1940s and early 1950s. Common Cause was a prototype of, and a sister organization to, the CIA-sponsored National Committee for a Free Europe. Its directors included many of the men, Adolf Burley, Arthur Bliss Lane, and Eugene Lyons, among others, who simultaneously led CIA-financed groups such as the NCFE and later the American Committee for Liberation from Bolshevism. Boldyreff's speaking and writing tour in this country became one of the first rallying cries in the United States for a liberationist political agenda. The campaign aimed at winning financial and popular support for the NTS as a weapon in clandestine warfare against the USSR. And it goes, this account of Boldyreff goes on to describe how his views were widely publicized through both the electronic and print media. We're going to see that phenomenon in just a few minutes, not with Boldyreff specifically, but with others. Now, one of the points that Simpson makes in his next section is the point that many of the Galen-related emigre who came to play a pivotal role in the formation of liberation or rollback philosophy, and this, again, as a result of their projection into a domestic American political life by CIA domestic organizations such as the Crusade for Freedom, that's one of the goals sought by many of these Galen-related emigre was the precipitation of a war between the United States and the Soviet Union with the effect of having these very same emigre installed in the Soviet Union as political leaders after the defeat of the USSR. Now recall, that is basically the same goal that the NTS had vis-a-vis the Third Reich. They ultimately sought to prevail on the Third Reich to install them as the leaders of a Third Reich puppet state in the former USSR. And it should be noted here that what we're looking at is essentially a foreign agenda, an agenda originally developed by elements associated with the Third Reich, such as the NTS, and we are looking at the proposed use of the United States by these elements in the same capacity that they attempted to use Nazi Germany. Namely, they sought to use the U.S. as a tool for defeating the USSR and ultimately projecting themselves into the political leadership of what would have been the USSR. And also take note of the fact that the political influence of many of these groups was greatly expanded by the sympathies they were able to generate within many of the large ethnic voting blocks within American cities. Many American cities have large Eastern European emigre communities, and many of these same Third Reich and Galen-related elements were able to find very responsive audiences and influential audiences within these particular communities. Simpson writes, the emigre anti-communist movement continued to accelerate. Soon there emerged in the United States, quote, one vocal and not uninfluential element that not only wanted war with Russia, but had a very clear idea of the purposes for which, in its own view, such a war should be fought, unquote, as George Kennan noted later in a discussion of his views on the possibility of war with the USSR during the early 1950s. Quote, I have in mind the escapees and immigrants, mostly recent ones, from the non-Russian portions of the post-war Soviet Union, as well as from some of the Eastern European satellite states. Quote, their idea, he writes, to which they were passionately and sometimes ruthlessly attached, was simply that the United States should, for their benefit, fight a war against the Russian people to achieve the final breakup of the traditional Russian state and the establishment of themselves as the regimes of the various, quote, liberated, unquote, territories, unquote. Kennan is referring here to the spokesman of the so-called captive nations movement, particularly Ukrainian and Baltic nationalists. I would interject here, ultimately, as we can see from 1992, that goal was achieved not through the fighting of a hot war, but rather through the successful prosecution, or at least successful, from their standpoint, prosecution of the Cold War. The Soviet Union was indeed bankrupted. There was indeed a mutiny by the Red Army following the attempted August 1991 coup. The Soviet Union, in alliance with the goals of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, did indeed break up into its constituent ethnic republics, and as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 36, organizations like the RUK organization, R-U-K-H in the Ukraine, which looks for its political heritage to the OUN B group of Stefan Bandera, who we looked at earlier in RFA 37, as well as organizations like Sąjūdis in Lithuania, which basically takes its political heritage from Lithuania's fascist period prior to World War II and its occupation by the Soviets. We basically see the successful realization of the agendas of these groups as a result of the U.S. basically fighting the Cold War and bankrupting the Soviet Union and pretty much bankrupting itself in the process. So again, the goals sought here, originally goals of Third Reich political warfare vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and covert action, have been realized as a result of their incorporation into the United States. We'll take a look at just how that happened. This happened in subsequent installments of RFA 37. We also took a look at we took a look at this process in detail. But note that the liberation philosophy, originally a Third Reich political warfare and covert action strategy, introduced into the United States as a result of domestic action by CIA organizations, chiefly the CFF, which projected many of these same Galen-related elements into the American political mainstream, where their philosophy became a dominant American political force. Ultimately, their goal, beginning as a Third Reich political warfare technique, has been realized, and many of these same elements are indeed in the driver's seat in not only the member republics of the former Soviet Union, but some of the Eastern European states as well, notably the aforementioned Croatia, where Franjo Tudjman, the current head of Croatia, denies the Holocaust and has pretty much revived the whole Ustashi agenda, something which has been eclipsed in all of the publicity concerning the Serbian atrocities or alleged atrocities towards the Bosnians. There have certainly been some atrocities. I suspect that there's also been some exaggeration. Continuing with Simpson's account, these recent refugees were by no means without political influence in Washington, Kennan adds. Connected as they were with the compact voting bloc situated in the big cities, they were able to bring direct influence to bear on individual congressional figures. They appealed successfully at times to religious feelings and even more importantly to the prevailing anti-communist hysteria, unquote. Among the countries the captive nations movement represented were several that the diplomat admits had been, quote, invented in the Nazi propaganda ministry during the war, unquote. Agitation by these émigrés became a part of dozens of CIA-sponsored exile operations in the United States during the early 1950s. Almost all these affairs were sponsored by the CIA Covert Operations Directorate's International Organizations Division, which was then administering the NCFE, the CFF, and similar overlapping projects. This division organized and bankrolled the CFF with an initial grant of $180,000, according to former RFERL, that's Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Chief Mickelson, or Radio Liberation Chief Mickelson, M-I-C-K-E-L-S-O-N. The CIA, working through the NCFE, then went on to pour at least $5 million into CFF propaganda work inside the United States over the next 5 years. I would interject that $5 million in the early 50s was many times what it is worth, to what was worth many times what $5 million would be worth today. Continuing, that $5 million figure is only a pale reflection of the true scope of the CFF's effort, however. The campaign arranged with the Nonprofit Advertising Council of America for thousands of hours of free radio and television time, as well as for countless free magazine and newspaper promotions. The crusade paid only for the actual production of the proliferation of the pro-liberation political advertising, which was then broadcast or published without charge by media outlets enjoying substantial tax deductions for airing these, quote, public service, unquote, announcements. This unique program, quote, made it possible for the American people to read, hear, and see the crusade story in all media of communications, unquote. The National Committee for a Free Europe boasted in an annual report, including, quote, newspapers, magazines, outdoor advertising, radio, television, and newsreels, unquote. But the CIA's $5 million direct contribution to anti-communist education through the CFF can serve at least as a yardstick for comparing the scope of the crusade promotion to other political propaganda efforts undertaken in this country at about the same time. That $5 million contribution exceeds, for example, the combined total of all the money spent on the Truman-Dewey presidential election campaign of 1948. It establishes the CIA, through the CFF, as the largest single political advertiser on the American scene during the early 1950s, rivaled only by such commercial giants as General Motors and Procter & Gamble in its domination of the airwaves. So again, not only does the CFF's $5 million contribution coming from the CIA exceed the combined cost of the Truman-Dewey presidential election campaign in 48, it placed the CIA and CFF as the largest single political advertiser on the American scene in this period, and basically rivaling commercial giants like GM and Procter & Gamble as the main advertisers on the American airwaves. And note, as Simpson has documented here, as he has discussed, that in addition to the $5 million, a great deal of free advertising was obtained by these very same groups, and that in turn greatly expanded the influence of the CFF with its Galen and related emigre people at the core of not only their political organizations, but at the core of their philosophical generation as well. Continuing here with Simpson's account, what we're going to look at now is a related program in which CIA-sponsored organizations not only took to the airwaves, but basically sponsored scholastic propaganda slash research on behalf of many of these same Galen Third Reich emigre organizations and individuals, and again, this by way of propagating the rollback or liberation philosophy into American society, where it became a dominant political force. And once again, I want to reiterate that the actions of these organizations and the CFF, the Galen-related elements, these Eastern European and fascist exiles, or emigres, I should say, they should not be seen as operating in a vacuum, but rather the effect they had was precisely as a result of their interaction with other major American domestic political forces. And basically what we're looking at is the formation of what might be termed a community of interests, what the Germans referred to as an Interessengemeinschaft. Although the organizations worked together, some of their motivations were differing to a certain extent, overlapping but not coterminous. So again, the influence, the profound influence that these Galen-related elements had in American society as a result of their projection into American political life by the CIA was as a result of the way in which they were able to interact with major domestic political forces. Continuing with Simpson's account, the crusade was only part of a much broader CIA-sponsored effort to shape U.S. and world public opinion. Related programs included book publishing, scholarly studies of the USSR by carefully selected researchers, and bankrolling hundreds of rallies, commemorations, and other media events. The principal political point of this program was to provide extensive publicity for all available evidence that the USSR was a dangerous imperial power. The agency went on to emphasize news of the, quote, liberation movements of the exiles as an important morale booster and an illustration of the resistance to Soviet expansion. The CIA financed a literary campaign explicitly designed to promote former Nazi collaborators as appropriate leaders of liberation movements among their respective nationalities. That last sentence again, because it's a key. The CIA financed a literary campaign explicitly designed to promote former Nazi collaborators as appropriate leaders of liberation movements among their respective nationalities. The German author Heinz Bongartz, pen name Jürgen Torvald, recounts how he was approached in 1950 by a CIA officer named Pleasants with a proposal that he write a promotional account of the Vlasov Army for distribution in both the United States and Europe. Spellings here, by the way. Heinz Bongartz is B-O-N-G-A-R-T-Z. Jürgen Torvald is J-U-Umlaut R-G-E-N-T-H-O-R-W-A-L-D. And, of course, Pleasants is like pleasant with an S. Continuing. Pleasants had read an earlier Bongartz tract that was strongly sympathetic to Vlasov and, quote, he thought I would be the right fellow to write further material on the subject, Bongartz remembers. The German author accepted Pleasants' offer. The CIA, with the cooperation of Hans Danko Hera, a senior officer in the Galen organization, provided him with stenographers, translators, travel expenses, a substantial grant access to secret U.S. records, and assistance in locating SS and Vlasov Army veterans scattered all over Europe. Now, the spelling of this Galen operative who collaborated with the CIA's Pleasants and Heinz Bongartz, a.k.a. Jürgen Torvald, his name is Heinz Danko, D-A-N-K-O-H-E-R-R-E. Continuing with Simpson's account, Bongartz's glowing report of Vlasov was published in German and English 2 years later, and it remains an often cited work in the field. The book presents a thoroughly whitewashed picture of the Vlasov movement, but Bongartz deserves credit at least for openly discussing the sponsors of his book, more than can be said for a number of other scholars of the period. This broad-based, multifaceted effort legitimized for many Americans what the extreme right-wing emigre movement had been saying since the end of World War II. The United States could easily liberate Eastern Europe from the Soviet Union and even dismember the USSR, the theory went, by bankrolling stepped-up subversion programs in the East. Quote, it became an article of faith that the USSR was going to fall apart at any time, unquote, notes scholar Vladimir Petrov, P-E-T-R-O-V. By the way, you're calling him a scholar here is perhaps giving him a little more credit than he deserves. He is part and parcel of this whole Galen milieu that we're looking at this evening. Continuing, quote, the idea was that communism was a small conspiracy of men sending out the revolution, that it was hated by the people, and so naturally they wanted to overthrow it right away. Communists killed people to maintain their power, so the first chance the people had, there would be a rebellion. John Foster Dulles articulated this myth neatly in one congressional testimony that went entirely unchallenged at the time. Some dozen people in the Kremlin, he proclaimed, are seeking to consolidate their imperial rule over some 800 million people, representing what were nearly a score of independent nations. Unquote. With those kinds of odds, 800 million against 12, the overthrow of communism from within would seem like a fairly simple task. Quote, that was the theory at the time, unquote, Petrov says, again quoting, there was a lot of enthusiasm. Many people thought that communism could be very simply gotten rid of, unquote. But in reality, Petrov reflects with a sigh, this just wasn't true, unquote. The liberation message struck an extraordinarily responsive chord in the United States, one which reverberated far beyond the relatively narrow community of Eastern European exiles. Its potent blend of anti-communist paranoia, American patriotism, and the self-perceived generosity of doing something practical to aid people seen as suffering from persecution abroad appealed to millions of Americans. Skipping down, the role of former Nazi collaborators and U.S. intelligence agencies in promoting the penetration of liberationist political thinking into the American body politic may be traced through several clear steps. First, the rhetoric and the detailed strategies for the, quote, liberation, unquote, of the USSR and Eastern Europe were originally generated before World War II by pro-fascist émigré organizations enjoying direct sponsorship from Nazi Germany's intelligence agencies, which were intent on using these groups as pawns in their plans to exterminate European Jewry and to achieve a military victory in the East. The Nazis significantly developed both the liberation strategies and their exile constituencies during the war, despite the Germans' own internal faction fighting over how to make best use of the collaborators. Last sentence, couple of sentences again. Now bear in mind, too, that in addition to the media blitz conducted by the Crusade for Freedom and their allied free media publicity, a major campaign of scholarship, of research and publishing to promote these same ideas, the liberationist thinking, was also conducted. Again, we took a look at Jürgen Torvald, a.k.a. Heinz Bongartz, and how the CIA and a Galen operative named Heinz Danko Hera were utilized to help generate his particular book. That is but one example of it. But again, the basic thesis of the generation of liberation is stated in these next few sentences by Simpson. The role of former Nazi collaborators and U.S. intelligence agencies in promoting the penetration of liberationist political thinking into the American body politic may be traced through several clear steps. First, the rhetoric and the detailed strategies for the, quote, liberation, unquote, of the USSR and Eastern Europe were originally generated before World War II by pro-fascist émigré organizations enjoying direct sponsorship from Nazi Germany's intelligence agencies, which were intent on using these groups as pawns in their plans to exterminate European Jewry and to achieve a military victory in the East. The Nazis significantly developed both the liberation strategies and their exile constituencies during the war, despite the Germans' own internal faction fighting over how to make best use of the collaborators. Secondly, after the war, U.S. intelligence agencies brought leaders of a number of these pro-fascist groups, the Ukrainian OUN, the Russian nationalist NTS, the Albanian Bali Kombatar, B-A-L-L-I, capital K-O-M-B-E-T-A-R, certain of the Baltic Nazi collaborators, etc., into the United States through programs, the specific purpose of which was in part the generation of effective anti-communist propaganda. Next, these same exile leaders aggressively promoted essentially the same liberation propaganda in the United States that they had advocated under Nazi sponsorship, though now with a new appeal to American values such as democracy and freedom, rather than the earlier open advocacy of racial politics and fascism. The CIA gave these domestic publicity campaigns multi-million-dollar clandestine backing during the 1950s by providing operating cash, salaries, and logistic and publishing support, and, not least, by facilitating endorsements from respected mainstream politicians. Now, in the next section of Blowback about liberation philosophy, we're going to see the evolution of this Third Reich political and clandestine warfare strategy, and we will see how, through the steps enumerated by Simpson in the passage I just finished, this evolved into a major influence on the 1952 Republican campaign, and this by way of taking a look at the evolution of this Third Reich political warfare strategy into a dominant American political force. Also note here that the main Republican spokesman in the main Republican functionary, I should say, in helping to promote the liberation philosophy as a major element of the 1952 Republican campaign platform is a fellow named Arthur Bliss Lane, L-A-N-E, Bliss, of course, B-L-I-S-S. Now, at the same time as he was serving as the point man for the Republicans' liberation plank or for their liberation philosophy, he was also serving on the board of directors for both the CIA's National Crusade, National Committee for a Free Europe, and the Crusade for Freedom. So at the same time as he's working in the, with the Republican Party, he's also working for the CIA's NCFE and CFF, which are instrumental, again, in promoting liberationist philosophy in the United States. And as we will see, and as Simpson notes, ultimately, the liberation philosophy of the Republican Party and the CFF's program became virtually indistinguishable, and of course Arthur Bliss Lane is a dominant factor in both.